This hard-to-tear, all-purpose tape had been used to secure everything from lights on ceilings to cameras on car fenders. It most certainly would suffice to keep a blade plastered to Scott's torso. The scene you really want to replay, though, is two or three of us huddled around Scott, attempting to get the horrid tape off without exfoliating him more than necessary. Scott decided that only he really knew his own threshold for pain and yanked the sticky substance off. The end results were far too horrifying to put in any film. Another Super 8 standby was brought up to Marshall, courtesy of Scott's employment at the Walnut Lake Market, canned cherry cobbler. This provided a perfectly thick, pulpy substance for Mary Valenti to vomit out upon being stabbed in the neck. Titanic can have all of its fancy computer graphics. I'll take a good off-brand pie filling any day. This shoot also required my first full-on monster makeup. During the course of the film, my character is found horribly mauled in the woods, and later I appear as a possessed creature. Without the luxury of an extended shoot, our scheduling demanded for shooting horror at night and horror in the morning. Roughly translated, it meant that Bruce slept in his makeup. I was still on the waning edge of that perceived indestructibility teenagers are blessed with, so I didn't think much about it at the time. When the shoot was over, however, I realized that my skin had undergone a disturbing change of the DNA variety. Where the latex makeup had been applied, fascinating patterns began to emerge. Coincidentally, they were shaped exactly like my latex appliances. These rash-like apparitions remained with me for months, a lingering reminder of blatant stupidity. I also found out after the fact that the stuff I was almost always drooling as a monster was actually black latex paint. Hell, who needs a functioning intestinal system? We had great-looking bile. Within the woods, as well as serving as a prototype, allowed us to experiment more extensively with the concept of fakery. It was the first time, in the interest of getting the most out of our schedule, that we blacked out windows to provide the false illusion of night. It was also one of the few times that we actually filmed outdoors at night, all night. Despite the newfound hardships, the film came together very well. It was our first collective effort to actively pursue a genre, and it worked. Sam had clearly made strides as a filmmaker, and I began to get a basic grip on this elusive acting thing. Well, okay, it wasn't acting per se, but I had taken a baby step beyond the mugging for the camera phase. Once assembled, we did our own brand of test marketing to see if Within the Woods would get a response from regular civilians. What could be a better proving ground than our old high school? A screening was arranged and the feedback was good and loud. Hell, this film got a better response than 6 months to live. We weren't experienced filmmakers by any means yet, but this audible feedback was all the encouragement we needed to take the next step. Chapter 13. There's no budget like low budget. We had a useful prototype, but what was the next step? The how question still fluttered about. With Michigan, you had to plan months ahead just to factor in the weather. Summer 1979 became the target for shooting, but we had to get our act in gear. Mayflowers were already in full bloom. Before we attempted to raise any money, we had to figure out how much was needed. For the first time, we had to determine, in advance, what our film might cost. This was an entirely foreign concept to us, since we had always casually pooled our loose cash and shot whenever we could and with whomever was available. A professional endeavor like this would call for renting equipment that wasn't ours, using a real film lab, and yikes, even paying people. In my year as a production assistant not long before this, I had become reasonably familiar with a number of motion picture suppliers in Detroit who catered to commercial producers. Technically, we were just doing a long commercial, so we gathered price lists and began to jot some numbers down. Long before the days of budgeting software, we started with a blank sheet of paper. Not knowing any other method, we proceeded to make the film in our heads, reviewing every phase of the production. Okay, we got to rent equipment. What equipment? For how long? What do you pay production assistants? Should we pay them at all? There were the odd how to make an independent film guides available, so we got our hands on whatever we could at the local bookstore. Our little hand-hewn budget began to grow and grow. Eventually, it reached an inconceivable $150,000. For all we knew about raising money, it might as well have been a million. Being so immersed in the Super 8 format, we convinced ourselves that we would save lots of money if we shot our feature in that same format and blew it up, enlarged it, later to the industry standard of 35mm. Was this an insane idea? We had never seen a film in a theater that was originally made in Super 8, but there was always a first time. A company in San Francisco, Interformat Labs, could fill the obscure request. The fellow in charge, Mike Hinton, sent us a test of a film that was shot in Caracas, Venezuela on Super 8mm and blown up by them to 35mm. When the test arrived, we marched down to our local Maple 3 theaters in Birmingham and screened it. The print looked okay, but just okay. We asked the projectionist what he thought about the quality of the film. He assumed it was a blow-up from 16mm, a fairly standard process. This was very encouraging to us, but we proceeded to test it for ourselves. This turned out to be a really good idea. What resulted was terror at Lulu's, as in Lulu's lingerie. Sam's mother had recently opened a string of these shops, and it seemed like the perfect place to stage a clockwork-like film. We cast another aspiring actress, Liz Dennison, as an unsuspecting woman working late at night who was terrorized by a mysterious man-slash-thing. This wasn't so much a story as a technical test, and it only took one night to put this small sequence together. We merely wanted to assemble enough shots, light, dark, and in between, to satisfy our curiosities of how each exposure would hold up in a blow-up process. On the advice of the San Francisco lab, we used a Beaulieu, the very best Super 8 camera we could find with a very specific film stock. We rented professional lights for the first time and used professional cameraman Steve Mandel to shoot the thing. In short, we did everything we could to make it work. The results once back from the lab in San Francisco were nothing short of disastrous. Screening it again at the same local theater, we stared slack-jawed at an image that was obscured by enormous globs of grain. It looked like the action was taking place in a hailstorm. This was a real blow. Our budget, meager as it was, didn't seem to support the jump to a more expensive format. On a hot, depressing day in June, the three of us sat on Rob's screened-in porch, trying to make the decision to go forward or stop dead in our tracks. We reasoned that a number of the then-classic low-budget horror flicks had been shot in 16mm. By making the leap to that millimeter, we were, in reality, merely making it all the more possible to pull off. We decided, after some wailing and gnashing, to blast ahead in the new format. Chapter 14. Three Schmoes in Search of a Clue. We reasoned that another impediment to raising money was credibility. Three guys with no professional experience, questionable education, and a dream to make a film in Detroit wouldn't exactly make the average investor dive into his pocketbook. We had to shake the flaky image of filmmakers and conquer the Midwest kick-the-tires mentality. If we were going to immerse ourselves in the world of business, we had to look like businessmen. Mostly this meant we had to dig up, dust off, or just plain buy a suit. Fortunately, a love of cool old suits gave me a leg up. I already had accumulated three or four vintage double-breasted wool outfits. My basic theory had been to haunt Salvation Army stores with a methodical zeal, and soon I knew when and where to look for the good stuff. An annual church bazaar in a wealthy neighborhood produced a great bounty as well, castaways from the Detroit elite. Hell, if it was good enough for the Fords and the Fishers, it was good enough for me. My usual layout for a primo suit was $25. Dump another 15 to 20 on top of that for tailoring, $10 for some two-tone wingtip shoes, you got yourself, on average, a $50 masterpiece. I was styling in the Motor City. We also needed briefcases, so it was off to Montgomery Ward. I opted for the double-wide, while Rob and Sam took the sleek, slimline models. Aside from all the trimmings, we needed confirmation that we were real. Of course, we felt qualified, but a second opinion from someone actually in the film business who could bless us from on high seemed like a useful thing. The only professional person we knew, a family friend of the Tapperts, was a film exhibitor at Butterfield Theaters in Detroit. We set up an appointment at Andy Granger's downtown offices. Walking into his lobby was like stepping into a time warp. His receptionist still used the 40s-style plug-and-patch phone system, and the walls were adorned in a rich wood paneling. Appropriately, I was wearing one of my aforementioned vintage suits. Andy's advice was simple. "Fellas, no matter what you do, keep the blood running down the screen." As a tribute to him specifically, there's a scene in the finished film where an old film projector whirs to life and projects blood running down the screen. Most importantly, Mr. Granger provided the name of a distributor in New York City whom we could approach for possible distribution, Levitt Pickman Films. Their claim to fame at the time had been Groove Tube, featuring a very young Chevy Chase. Little did we know that a letter of, quote, intent was all one could really expect without a finished film, but that was good enough for us, and we set up an appointment to meet with them. I'm not sure what dream world we lived in, but we were convinced that the only way to get to New York was by train. Bruce, wasn't that kind of an absurd concept? Sam, well, we didn't have a car that would make it. No, we didn't. Sam, we'll take a train. Bruce, yeah, we'll take a train to New York City. Sam, it was affordable. I think the tickets were like $40. We arranged to stay at Andrea's apartment. I had met her on a Chevy industrial shoot, and we hit it off very well. So well, in fact, that as we prepared for bed in her New York apartment, she came on to me like I'd never experienced before. Sam, so how did she come on to you? Did she just put her arm around you or something? No, she was like, you're sleeping in my bed, and that's going to be that. She was giving me the look, and even though I didn't know shit about women, I knew something awful was going to happen, and I knew I had to get out of there. And so you left that night. Yeah, I told her, I have to drive back because I've got a lot of stuff I have to do. This remains a great source of amusement to Rob and Sam. My only consolation was that Andrea's cat slept on Sam's face, and by morning, his eyes were swollen shut. Humiliation aside, we came back to Detroit with a letter of intent to distribute. Chapter 15. Do you validate? The next step was to get some notice of our abilities artistically. We had a pseudo-seal of approval from a major distribution company in New York City, but there was no outside opinion of our capability as filmmakers. In August of that year, we got whiff of a theater on the east side of Detroit, the Punch and Judy, that ran Rocky Horror every weekend and whose management was, quote, open and flexible. We approached them with our idea of showing Within the Woods just before Rocky Horror. To our shock and delight, they agreed. The only real battle with this screening was a technical one. A Super 8 projector has limited bulb power, so we had to set the thing up halfway down the aisle in the theater. It became a game of, the image is too dim, move it closer. Well, if we move it closer, the picture isn't big enough. Eventually, with the help of a new $21.10 EFR halogen 150-watt 15-volt bulb, we found a happy medium. A trip to Radio Shack provided the hundreds of feet of audio extension cable needed to patch our feeble projector amplifier into the theater sound system. The distance, combined with a lousy source material, resulted in a slightly annoying hum, but hey, we were in a legit house. The, quote, cult crowd gathered to see Rocky Horror seemed to share enough basic interest in real horror to enjoy themselves. To combat the fact that we scored the film with music we didn't own the rights to, we decided to donate the proceeds to the American Cancer Society. A week after the showing, I dropped off a check for all of $11.40 to the Cancer Society, about half of what the new fancy bulb cost. On a side note, I had a chance to discuss the cult thing with Rocky Horror star Tim Curry several years later at the top of the Irazu volcano between shots of the film Congo. I told him how, indirectly, I was grateful that Rocky Horror provided us with such a good springboard. He explained that I wasn't alone. He had gotten a number of thank you notes from independent theater owners across the country, applauding him for being involved in a film that eventually proved to be the difference between success and failure for their theater. The net benefit of that weekend was bamboozling Michael McWilliams, a reviewer from the Detroit News, to come and see Within the Woods. It was refreshing to know that even in Detroit, people still got excited over homegrown stuff. Several days later, we saw what would become our calling card printed in the Lively Arts section of the Detroit News. It was the first, best, and perhaps most important review we've ever gotten. Nothing felt better than to slap that review on the desk of a potential investor and casually ask, "Read the paper today?" Chapter 16. The Quest for Moolah. Okay, the big ball was rolling. We had a prototype, a budget, a decided millimeter, a bogus letter from a professional, and our art had been validated. Now we had to get to the heart of the matter, the raw, stinking cash to make the movie. How do we raise money, we asked ourselves. Within the Woods cost a whopping $1,600. We needed an amount that was exponentially more. A bank wasn't just going to fork over $150,000 unsecured. Our friends and family weren't fat cat rich either. So, what do? Enter Phil Gillis, the Tappert family lawyer. Phil had helped a younger, wilder Rob get out of trouble a time or two, and he walked us through the steps of forming a business, quote, entity, whereby we could raise the dough. He recommended a limited partnership because of its simplicity. Simplicity, that's a good one. This private placement memorandum used terms like fiduciary responsibilities and willful malfeasance, not exactly common usage for us. Reading the agreement of limited partnership for the first time was like taking a fistful of melatonin, a one-way ticket to Snoresville. Phil and his partners were unimpressed with our prototype, letter of intent, or our cool review. It merely represented the good news. An offering like this had to be very careful about hype. Phil suggested that other terms would serve us better in the eyes of an investor, things like financial projections and a tax statement. I got to tell you, that first meeting with our new CPA, Charlie Bossler, about financial projections was a joke. Charlie, how soon do you think you'll recoup? Bruce, recoup? Well, get your money back. Rob, it's going to take the better part of 6 months to make the thing. Charlie, better make it a year. Sam, yeah, a year. That should be plenty safe. Charlie, now, how much money do you think you'll make with the film? What do you project? Bruce, Sam, Rob, that is, I... The reality was, and still is, that a finished film lives on a 35mm strip of negative. It could be worth nothing more than the stock it's printed on, or it could be the next Titanic. So we decided, oh, what the hell, they'll double their money in 2 years. If we had to live or die by the accuracy of the projection we came up with, I wouldn't be typing right now. I'd be drinking Woolite on the street corner in downtown Detroit. The truth was, we broke even exactly 6 years later. Investors, we came to learn, also got really pissy about taxes. What's the fuss all about, I wondered. I didn't even qualify for a bracket. Folks with something to lose, however, needed a tax opinion. Once these items were in place, we had to scrape together a resume for the offering. You know, one that showed things like experience. I worked as a newspaper delivery boy for a year, earned enough money to buy a black and white TV set. How's that? I swept studios out for a year and took my boss home when he was drunk. Is that good enough? I was a cab driver for a year. Want to see my chauffeur's license? Acting experience. Yeah. I'm a veteran of several community theater productions, and I also starred in at least 30 Super 8 films. You can almost see the investor's jaw just drop open. We slapped the lawyer-approved document together and found, much to our shock and utter horror, that we had exactly 30 days to raise the cash or the offering would expire. You gotta be kidding me. On top of that, because it was a private placement, we couldn't advertise in any way whatsoever. No radio ads, no newspapers, no mass mailings, and there was a limit to how many people you could even approach. These strict guidelines were designed to protect the average schmuck investor, but it certainly didn't do us any favors. As a potential investor, the first thing you were treated to on page one was the following. Warning. The securities offered by this document are highly speculative, will have no market, and should be considered only by an investor who has no plans to resell this security and fully and adequately understands the risk involved and can afford to lose his entire investment. Really instills confidence, doesn't it? We also had to disclose anything that might go wrong for any reason. These were known as risk factors. We stopped listing them after 11. It seemed embarrassing enough. They were as follows, with translation. Number one, it was a new venture, meaning we hadn't done anything yet. Number two, limited financial resources. It's a really low budget, folks. Three, lack of distribution agreement, meaning we have no real commitment from anyone. Four, reliance on management. Come hell or high water, investors were stuck with the three of us. Five, failure to engage certain key employees, meaning we haven't hired a single person yet. Six, liquidity of investment. As an investor, you were in it for the long haul. You couldn't sell your share on this venture even if it smelled like a stinker. Seven, federal tax consequences, meaning you can't write off anything. 8. No guarantee of completion, meaning if we go over budget, we're screwed. Where's the money going to come from? 9. Lack of diversification, meaning we're only doing one flick and it's a very specific genre. 10. Production risk. Bad weather, bad planning, bad anything could and will shut us down. 11. Conflict of interest, meaning we can do other stuff at the same time that might distract from this work here. Makes you just want to whip out the old checkbook and fire off 10 grand, doesn't it? Basically, an investor might as well have drilled for oil in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge with his or her bare hands because it was a total crapshoot. Combine these factors with the very practical sensibilities of Detroit businessmen, and you've got a grade-A challenge staring you in the face. Even if we had a prayer of answering questions from a savvy investor, we had to know this prospectus in and out. This became shockingly clear after our first few meetings. Mr. Turner, how much can I write off in the first year? Bruce, a fair amount? Mr. Gates, what's my liability, fellas? Sam, you're liable to make money? Mr. Trump, how do you handle phantom income? Rob, very, very carefully. Later, we learned to put an artful spin on our answers. Mr. Buffett, how much can I write off in the first year? Bruce, that's an excellent question, sir, for your tax attorney. Sultan of Brunei, what's my liability? Sam, you might want to consult your attorney on that. Mrs. Gottrocks, how can you handle phantom income? Rob, I'll bet your CPA has all kinds of ways. The unspoken rule of raising money was simple. Start with the people closest to you and branch out from there. My father was investor number one. A brave man, but I think Mom browbeat him into it. From relatives, you digress to friends. Hey, Stu, we had some great times in high school, didn't we? Hey, who would have thought you'd be the king of scrap metal today? Hey, listen, I want to talk to you about something. From friends, you move on to relatives of friends. Try my uncle. He's always doing crazy things like this. One particular uncle was a dentist. He ran in a pack with a bunch of other dentists, and they invested money in numerous ventures. A certain percentage of it, crazy. You haven't really lived until you've screened an unrated Super 8 film at a dinner party for four dentists and their wives, watching them squirm as a possessed creature, me in this case, bites off his own hand. The bad news was we ruined their meals. The good news was we got some moolah. But let's not forget the friends of friends. Hello, Mr. Stevens. This is Bruce Campbell. I'm a friend of Larry Dorfman, who's a friend of a woman who used to babysit your family. Anyway, ... Finally, you're stuck with the enemies of friends, and you realize that those people turn out to be your relatives, so you go back to them again. Last on the list, and arriving all too soon, were the cold calls. A shiver ran up my spine as I word-processed this recollection. Just getting past the secretary of a potential investor was an entirely fresh hell. Hello, my name is Bruce Gamble, and I'd like to speak with Mr. Jennings. No, he won't know what this is regarding, but I'm sure... What's that? This number? Oh, I got it out of the phone book and I... Hello? Hello? We met an amazing array of people that ran the gamut from honest professionals who were willing to sit through our clumsy pitch to the I could write you a check right now for the whole amount blowhard that deserved a slap in the face. One sales pitch was conducted during a football game. All right, so guys, if I invest in this thing... Oh, come on, Sanders, what are they paying you for? Trying to put the squeeze on a young dad while his kids played in the backyard was also extremely productive. You guys really think you can put this... Billy, that thing could put your eye out! I'm sorry, what was the question? We once screened within the woods at our old haunt, Walnut Lake Market, for the owners, in the soap aisle. I had mopped it many times while working there after high school, and at least knew where the power outlets were. Merchants turned out to be the toughest sell of all. They were used to getting something very tangible for their money, like a shipment of frozen chicken, so something as ethereal as a film didn't compute. It was always a special treat to screen our prototype, now badly scratched, in a corporate environment. Sam met a potential investor at the Kmart photo processing counter. Sam, I was bringing in rolls of raw stock to be processed, and he was there, and I think getting back some of his kids' pictures. He wanted to know why I was developing so many rolls of Super 8 film, and I said, oh, it's for a horror movie. We're making a feature version of it eventually. He said, well, gosh, I got some money. Call me if you guys ever need an investor. He gave me his card. I couldn't believe it. Bruce, funny thing about that guy was that he never saw the movie, right? Why not? Well, he didn't want to. He said, this is not my kind of movie. I can't handle this kind of movie. Show it to my colleagues. So we showed it to a group of guys in suits in his fancy boardroom. He invested blindly on the advice of his associates. The silver lining of this maddening process was the occasional domino effect, whereby one hard-fought investor led quickly to a multitude of others. One such investor happened to casually mention our film to a buddy while golfing. Sounds good, his friend said with a stroke of his pitching wedge. Count me in. He sent us the investment check sight unseen. To this day, we have only spoken to him on the phone. Living on the edge of a fading industrial city did have its advantages. Fortune 500 companies were easily within reach. Another investor, heir to the Delta Three-Way Faucet fortune, chipped in and several relatives followed suit without question. We also got some fairly clinical investments. One investor wasn't a person at all. It was a law firm pension fund. In this case, it was entity investing in entity. We also got what we would now call soft money. We prefer the term in-kind. Our lawyers agreed to invest their fees into the film. When this wasn't enough, we managed to get hard currency out of them as well. Another fella, clearly a man who had earned every dollar the hard way, informed us very casually that his investment was his Vegas gambling money and that he simply would refrain from going out west that year. Hundreds of screenings later, the summer had passed us by. November was knocking at our door, and the prospects of filming in northern Michigan during the winter seemed like a really bad idea. At this point, we did have some money in the bank. At $85,000, it was almost enough to start shooting. Unfortunately, our anal retentive legal document stipulated that all funds would be held in a special escrow account until $90,000 was reached, enough to get it in the can. Having hit this virtual cash wall, we were left with no other option than to beg. We sent a thinly veiled plea letter to the investors asking to release the funds early. There would be no adverse effects at all, we wrote. None except the fact that this was not nearly enough to make the film, and we had no prospects for getting another nickel out of the Motor City. Praise the film gods, the investors agreed, and we were on our way. Chapter 17. What else have I got to do for the next 6 weeks? With a bank account filled with investors' cash, it was time to get the big ball rolling. Phase 1, find actors. Real actors. Casting in Detroit became an interesting process. There were certainly actors, but all the legit folks I ran across as a production assistant were in that damnable Screen Actors Guild. Their type was way too expensive for our meager budget. The trick was finding qualified actors who wanted desperately to be in the union, but just hadn't figured out how yet. Theater wasn't huge in this culturally challenged town, so it took some research. Our first round of calls led us to agencies like Affiliated Models, the Wiest Barron School of Acting, and the ever-popular Spex Howard School of Broadcasting. Had we needed a good DJ, this would have been the right place, but actors, not quite. Sam, we took out an ad in the Detroit News, a little tiny ad. It probably looked like a porno picture, and they were supposed to meet in my basement. The whole thing sounded so seedy. Bruce, yeah, I remember, a lot of them came with their boyfriends. Sam, and with good reason with you here. Getting willing participants was anything but easy. Personally, as an actor, I was flabbergasted. Since when do you have to talk an actor into anything? Come on, Betsy, it'll be cool. You'll turn into a monster and we'll cover you in all kinds of horrible makeup. Then you attack your boyfriend and he, get this, cuts your head off and your decapitated body writhes all over him. Sound good? Most of our meetings took place in very public places. We met Teresa at the Nugget restaurant. Betsy Baker and fiancé met us at Pasquale's, an Italian joint, where Loretta and her escort met us 20 minutes later. On the other hand, Carol and her muscular mate preferred the upscale Bloomfield Charlie's. The big boy restaurant chain became the mainstay for future interviews. With bottomless cups of coffee and a killer lemon meringue pie, you couldn't have had a better office. "Casting again, fellas?" the waitress would inquire. "You know, I've done a commercial or two." The cast. By early October, we held official scream tests at Sam's house. We had readings, and they had two chairs, and they pretended they were driving a car, Sam recalled. Then we had them scream and shriek. From the trickle of hopefuls, we culled our actors. They were Teresa Seifert, daughter of the accountant who did our financial projections. Because she was a member of the Screen Actors Guild, and this was a decidedly non-union shoot, she felt compelled to change her name. She started with Teresa Tilly, then T. Tilly. We urged her to class it up a little and concocted the name Sarah York. Either way, it didn't work. The union found out and fined her. She was last heard of in Chicago working as a DJ. And a modern-day update to that, she's been touring with the Ladies of the Evil Dead, Ellen Sandweiss and Betsy Baker, as a group, and she's doing just fine. Betsy Baker. Back in the Motor City, she had done some industrials as a spokeswoman and was cast for her girl-next-door demeanor. After Evil Dead, she abandoned the acting life entirely and got into the motorhome rental business. Hey, made a hell of a lot of sense to me. Rich Demenancourt. With a what-else-have-I-got-to-do-for-the-next-6-weeks attitude toward the whole thing, Rich dove in. He also had union jitters, so Rich adopted the stage name Hal Delrich. This was the result of combining the first names of his roommates at the time, Hal and Del. Rich also got nabbed by the union and eventually worked his way out of the business. Last seen, driving a truck in rural Michigan. But then a modern-day update, I think he was working with a tile company. Ellen Sandweiss. As an old high school pal and former Super 8 starlet, she was a natural for the part. Ellen also phased out of show business after this film. I'm sensing a pattern here. She is currently living a respectable life as a married mother of two in Michigan. And her update is, she recently got divorced and decided to go back into the film business now that she's done with her soccer mom days. That guy named Bruce. A veteran of those same Super 8 films, but never did anything other than shtick acting. The concept of creating and maintaining a real character was a totally new concept. All actors were contracted to make a staggering $100 per week. Fortunately for us, this was well before the age of overtime, forced calls, meal penalties, night premiums, and residuals. It wasn't about money. An actor acted, period. The first read-through at Sam's house was a little on the clumsy side. It was really hard to get a sense of the film when the dialogue in the climax consisted of, no, I can't feel my legs. New Guineas. Had these poor actors read the fine print at the bottom of their contract, they would have seen the disclaimer, in addition, you will also be the guinea pigs for makeup testing. These heinous products have not been tested on animals because they will be tested on you. The actors destined to portray possessed monsters in the film, 4 out of 5, had to be fitted for sclero contact lenses. Now, these weren't your basic soft or disposable lenses for sensitive eyes. These suckers were glass, and covering 2/3 of the eye, they were big. To get the idea, run to your kitchen and shove a Tupperware lid over your eyeball. Because the glass lenses prevented the eye from breathing, they could only be kept in for 15 minutes at a time. Of course, getting them in took a full 10 minutes, so this was a pretty neat trick. As bad as it got during production, I could always nod to myself and chuckle, well, at least I don't have to wear those stinking lenses. I nodded a lot over the next 12 weeks. Because a number of these possessed characters ultimately were dismembered, it was necessary to make plaster molds of various appendages. The makeup techniques we used at the time were not that far off from those used on the original Frankenstein. When things called for a plaster mold, we simply poured plaster Paris directly on top of Vaseline-coated skin. Who wouldn't? Now, if you've ever had any experience with this form of plaster, you'd know that it heats up as it sets. Not a little, a lot. Betsy Baker, head-coated in this stuff, unable to see, hear, or talk, began to jot furiously on a pad of paper. Getting very warm. How much longer? Betsy's scrawls soon became more urgent. Getting very lightheaded. Must get out soon. Using implements the Three Stooges would have been proud of, we liberated her from her tomb only to find a full set of eyelashes perfectly preserved in the plaster. Needless to say, we had some explaining to do. And so the makeup test plodded along, resulting in raw limbs from excessive heat and unwanted hair removal, and strained eyes from numerous attempts to wear sclero lenses. It was unquestionably an omen of things to come. Crew Who. The ragtag behind-the-scenes group we conned into this adventure came from all walks of life. Steve Dart Frankel. He was very good with his hands. By way of carpentry, he became our art director. His hammer was affectionately referred to as Uru. Sam had first met this mythical man at Camp Tamaqua, situated in the Algonquin Park of northern Ontario, Canada. Dart was last seen in the South Island of New Zealand working as a chiropractor, still using his hands, hopefully not his hammer. Dave, quote, Goody Goodman, a longtime Raimi friend, Dave went all the way back. In his words, one time Sam was really being a pain in the ass. In their backyard, they had those prong-type fences, so Ivan, Sam's brother, and I hung him up on the fence by his pants and started spitting at him and hitting him, and he was stuck on the fence and couldn't do anything. The housekeeper saw what we were doing and came out with a broomstick and started chasing us until we took him down. during the course of this shoot, Dave will earn the dubious title of the filmmaker's burden. His official job was chef. Don, I Want to Break Stuff Campbell. Brother Don was a yahoo in search of an adventure. With no true interest in filmmaking, this was one of his few experiences on a set. His driving desire to work with us stemmed from the fact that a lot of stuff was going to get wrecked. Production assistants made $50 a week, so we couldn't really be picky. John Mason, sound man. He was an old teacher of mine during a very brief stint at Wayne State University in Detroit. John quit teaching and left his family to work on this film. Go figure. Tim Philo, cameraman. He came from the same university as John Mason and had actually shot the better part of a feature film before. What the hell, we thought. He seemed like a nice guy. Josh Becker. Obviously, Sam and I had already, quote, worked with him for years. As the shoot intensified and crew members began to drop like flies, Josh, in his own irascible way, became a key player and distinguished himself as one of the few who went the distance. Rob Tappert, Mr. Producer. In those days, producer meant doing anything that nobody else was doing or would do. This ran the gamut of fogging the background of a shot to pushing the wheelchair dolly. That's the real beauty of having no budget. The lines of who does what get very blurry. During production, when I wasn't acting, I'd toss a coat over my sticky, blood-soaked shirt and haul lights around. Tom Sullivan, makeup man. Tom was merely expanding what he had learned from our prototype within the woods. Aside from baking actors' body parts and subjecting them to noxious substances, he was a nice, quiet guy. Sam Raimi, writer, director, boy genius. He was technically a teenager when we started the project and had just turned 20 when filming began. This film was his rite of passage. It was always fun to see what shade of gray Sam turned on any given day, depending on how few hours he had slept. I got a perverted comfort in knowing that as hard as he pushed the cast and crew, he always pushed himself just a little harder. Rob, Sam, and I were contracted as executive producers for $35 a week in expenses, which we never collected. We had never been paid on anything else. Why start now? I recall attempting to buy a pack of gum during the shoot and realizing that I simply had no money to pay for it. Pick a state, any state. We now had the cast and crew, but where would we shoot the film? Michigan had never been big on the "let's get Hollywood to film here" thing, so there were no formal agencies to assist in finding a location. We needed a house on a hill, a chasm, and winding rural roads. We contacted the Michigan Travel Bureau, but nothing came of it. We even checked out a creepy suburban house we used to pass on our high school bus, but since it was on the corner of two very busy streets, we decided to keep looking. Michigan was rapidly becoming out of the question. Daily frost and incessant drizzle confirmed that. It was the end of October already, and the only way to avoid assuredly inclement weather was to head south. The Tennessee Film Commission, much to their credit, made the best case for shooting there. In fact, they were the only state that seemed to give a rat's ass. On November 9th, there was no going back. Ready or not, emphasis on not, we loaded up several cars and a truck and pointed the convoy south on Interstate 75. Rob and Sam had scouted a location in the town of Morristown, Tennessee, about 40 miles northeast of Knoxville. I'd like to say that it was sleepy or quaint, but it wasn't. It was just a small town in rural America. We managed to find a fairly large house several miles outside of town where everyone stayed, 13 people in all. With 6 bedrooms, it would work if most of us slept in groups. Josh and Goodman became unlikely bedfellows. Bruce, where'd you sleep? Josh, I slept in that back bedroom with Goody. We were in the same bed. Ugh, you shared a bed with Goodman? Josh, yeah, I finally got to the point where he was so aggravating I pulled the box springs out and I slept on the box springs and let him have the mattress. He was like some horrible monster. When the crew later ballooned to 17, the accommodations became downright collegiate, averaging 2.83 persons per room. With actresses each rating a single room, we had to break out cots, and the living room took on a whole new meaning. Tom Sullivan, the odd man out, claimed the laundry room. More on that later. Deep in the heart of. One day during our rushed preparations, I had to draw a chunk of cash from the local bank. It had the funniest smell. "This money smells like dirt," I said to the teller. "Makes sense," she explained. "Folks around here still bury it in their backyard." We were not in Detroit anymore. A cabin that had been secured from the previous scouting mission fell through at the last minute. This led to a mad rush to find a new location. Enter Gary, here's the deal I worked out, Holt. This man was our first introduction to the South circa 1979. He was classic in every sense. His entrepreneur background consisted of record producing, previously owned cars, and dwarf tossing. His client, Percy Ray, was a diminutive black man who specialized in a mean Mr. T impersonation. Gary circulated Percy as a tossee in local bars. Apparently, good old boys were more than happy to pony up for the chance to chuck old Percy Ray as far as they could. He was all in good fun, you understand, Gary would explain. Gary had also worked as a chauffeur in Memphis way back and had the privilege of driving Elvis on one mystical occasion. He explained it this way. Now, I ain't queer or nothing, but as I drove him around, I could feel that he had a magnetism. But I ain't queer or nothing. We were later treated to a song he produced in Memphis. A woeful tale about Vietnam, this spoken song lauded the soldiers of the United States Marine Corps. He was a real deer hunter, the lyrics droned. Not like that Fonda woman. As much as we appreciated his efforts, the quality and presentation of the song were so low grade that if any of us had made eye contact with each other, it would have all been over. Snickers were hastily disguised as coughs and sneezes. Still, when Gary wasn't masterminding some self-serving event, he led us around to various backwater places to find a cabin. In more really remote areas, as opposed to the regularly remote, Gary would insist that we wait in the car while he hollered at the prospective owners. We were fine with this. One location, a former first-class resort in the 20s, was now overrun by squatters. As a semi-sheltered suburban boy, I'd never encountered anything quite like this. Inside a former guest cabin sat the scruffiest, most rampantly bearded, dentally challenged folks you've ever seen. But they were gracious hosts, urging us to sit down a while with them on their orange crates or springless mattresses to chat. Home Sweet Home. Eventually, November 13th, a day before the shoot was to begin, the search led us to a cabin not far from our rented house. Visually, it was ideal. The rustic homestead boasted an overgrown driveway, easily a quarter mile long, that wound down into a feral, isolated valley. It was storybook Tennessee, something Ma and Pa Kettle would settle into. Practically speaking, however, the place was a bad idea waiting to come to fruition. As we soon found out, this was no ordinary cabin. There was something of a history to the old place. In the 30s, so the story goes, a young girl named Clara lived in the cabin with her family. One night, a terrible thunderstorm swept through the valley. During that storm, her parents were both brutally and inexplicably murdered. Our stunned girl, escaping that grim fate, wandered aimlessly until she was taken in by neighbors. To this day, apparently, every time there's a terrible storm, Clara would wander from the Morristown Manor rest home looking for her parents. She was found just days before we arrived, wandering in the hills behind our cabin. Now that's creepy, folks. Well, Clara or no Clara, the reality of it all was that there was no electricity, no running water, and no telephone service in the cabin. Cattle had the run of the place and had managed to deposit easily 4 inches of manure in every room. There were no doors, the rooms were very small, and the ceilings were claustrophobically low. This sucker needed work, a lot of it. Art director Dart reckoned it would take about a week of pretty hard work to get it in shape. But we had a film to shoot, so it was decided that the cabin would be prepped while some simple exterior shots were done. The general edict came down that anyone who wasn't actively filming had to work in the cabin, actors included. There were walls to be knocked out, ceilings to be raised, a trap door with a partial basement to be hollowed out, and years of newspaper-based wallpaper to be stripped away. Dart with a circular saw was something to behold. He cut out windows, evened out the front porch, and built furniture with a Hitchcockian flair, tilted at cockeyed angles. Ma and Pa Kettle would have been proud. Brother Don seemed to have a talent for stonework, so he was assigned to put a craggy face on the fireplace. Sam encouraged him to position the stones above the hearth like angry, jagged teeth. Eventually, power and telephone lines were installed and the basic work was completed. Our single rotary telephone sat in a bare back room. We never did get any kind of plumbing worked out, but that was all part of the charm. Chapter 18. On your marks, get set. November 14th, the race began. Right from the get-go, filming was a comedy of errors, or terrors, if you will. Within minutes of leaving for the first location, an abandoned bridge, the production van got lost and we spent a half hour trying to locate it. No sooner had we found it than Sam drove his Classic into a ditch and we had to get a tow truck to haul it out. The next location was an isolated dirt road. Sam felt that a high, wide shot would be best. We weren't versed in the etiquette of location shooting, so no effort was made to get permission of any kind. We just hopped the fence and set up the camera. Things were going pretty well until Josh spotted a large bull glaring at the crew. Sam, there's a bull, Josh stated flatly. Yeah, hang on, Sam replied, focused on the shot at hand. No, Sam, you don't get it. The bull is coming this way. Sam got it in a hurry, and he was chased about 100 yards by the angry bovine. Man, what's next, I thought. A cliff was next. About 2 hours later, Brother Don, scouting for an additional vantage point, lost his footing and tumbled headfirst off a cliff. Apparently, he was well enough to get up under his own power, but he was taken to the hospital for some tests. Other than that, day one was very productive. A week later, shooting a night scene at the same bridge location, Sam had a little run-in with a tree branch. A construction winch was drawn around the side of the bridge to bend a steel girder into position. Unbeknownst to anyone, the cable was also around a large tree branch that promptly snapped when tension was applied to the cable. It flattened Sam, a limb of easily 50 pounds. He staggered back and sat on the wrecker, dazed. "Sam, you okay?" I asked. "Why wouldn't I be?" he asked back, a blank look on his face. At first he seemed fine, but upon closer inspection he was pale, his lips were white and crusty, and a small amount of blood trickled from his left nostril. "Well, you don't look so good," I said. "What the hell happened?" "Oh, just needed to sit down for a little bit." With that he rallied himself and carried on shooting. On the way home that night he passed out cold. During the next 3 months, Evil Dead left a path of destruction through the South as wide as Sherman's march to the sea. Among other things, we destroyed the paint job of a white pickup truck, bent the housing of our 16mm camera, ripped the roof off a rental truck with the help of a low-slung tree branch, and crushed the septic system of my folks' house in northern Michigan. Sam, I am. When not plagued by Murphy and his endless series of laws, we did manage to get some work done. For instance, Sam made some remarkable strides as a visually oriented director. Early on, his directing style became evident. He was never big on shooting a master, usually a wide shot, allowing the scene to play from beginning to end. He was much more apt to break scenes down into a series of shots, based on his own indecipherable thumbnail sketches, and shoot only the pieces he needed. This afforded him a great deal of precision, but it's not a method that's applauded by your organically inclined actor. Funny thing was, the actors were all so green, myself included, that none of us really knew the difference. Sam also wasn't one for the standard medium shot, close-up, or over-the-shoulder angles that most film and television shows use to, quote, cover a scene. As an actor, I found myself being photographed from every conceivable angle. If Sam could have put that camera up my nose, I think he would have done it. There's an entire sequence in the film where every shot was photographed at a 45-degree, quote, Dutch, or tilted angle. That's quite severe. I must admit, we all thought Sam was crazy when this scheme was revealed, but he was the director. The results were very effective and hold up pretty well, even against the cockeyed MTV style used regularly today. As a result of Sam's boldness, this shot spawned a number of low-tech but unique camera rigs. Early tracking shots were easily accomplished from a wheelchair. When the moves needed to be smoother or more precise, the VasoCam was used. This was basically a poor man's dolly. It consisted of several 2x4s placed on top of sawhorses. The 2x4s were covered with silver duct tape, thereby providing a smooth, knot-free surface. The tape was then greased with household Vaseline. Next, the camera was bolted to a U-shaped wood device that laid on top of the Vaseline. Now, the camera could smoothly proceed along its track, stopping on a dime if need be. This device was lightweight, very portable, and, even better, really cheap. The next invention of necessity was the shaky cam. This was the polar opposite of its big-budget, hence completely unavailable to us, brother, the Steadicam. Our version was merely a 3-foot hunk of 2x6 board with the camera bolted in the middle. The cameraman slapped on a wide-angle lens, grabbed the board at either end, and ran like hell. On film, the end result was an evil, roaming entity that could leap tall shrubs in a single bound. Then there was the Elevator, named after its first victim, Ellen Sandweiss. This rig was based on an old magic trick and allowed her to float in the air as if possessed without wires. Sam, a former bar mitzvah-style magician, often used simple trickery in his films. To him, motion pictures were the ultimate sleight of hand. He once explained it this way. The point isn't just to make the film, it's to amaze yourself and everyone at the same time. If you think what you're doing is neat, chances are everyone else will too. But who could forget the Ramo cam? Need an evil entity to ram through a plate glass window? No problem. This rig consisted of a 2x4, what else, with a T-bar at the end, which would prevent injury by smashing the glass well ahead of the probing camera. With a total wholesale price of around $350, it also prevented costly budget overruns. When all else failed, we just taped the damn camera to Sam's hand. The opening shot of Evil Dead consisted of me pushing Sam in a rubber raft across a swamp while he leaned out, skimming the camera across the water and swooping over decaying branches. Lest you forget, the number one rule of the B-movie jungle is, when in doubt, make it up as you go along. Brinkmanship. Given the factors of inexperience, a distant location, and the early arrival of an unusually harsh winter, our perfect plan of a 6-week shoot rapidly turned into 8, then 10, then 12 weeks. Sam's script called for the main characters to endure countless woes during the course of one interminable night. It kind of worked this way. If you weren't possessed by a demon, you were chased by one. If you weren't killed, you were at least caught and soon wished that you had been. If you were killed, however, your character would come back to life as an unstoppable monster. As you might imagine, the actors were pushed to the brink of human endurance very quickly. One such scene called for Teresa Seifert's character to be hacked apart with an axe. Because the film had no rating, and we really didn't film any scenes to meet MPAA guidelines, Sam figured it would be cool to see her, quote, parts, flopping about on the floor. This required Teresa to be placed partially under the floor, with very specific boards fitted carefully around her neck. This way she could remain an animated, decapitated creature and torment those around her, torment being the operative word. Rob Tappert, who foolishly agreed to play her disembodied leg and arm, had to get into position next to her. Underneath the floorboards, their intertwined bodies resembled a perverted game of Twister. By the time everything was put into place, which was several hours later, Rob was getting horrible leg cramps. Teresa also felt that she had been uncomfortable long enough and was ready to get out. Sam, in a rare moment of compassion, agreed. That's when I had to step in. Look, guys, the whole thing sucks. Everyone's uncomfortable, but getting out right now isn't the answer because we're just going to have to put you back in again. Let's just shoot the damn thing right now and be done with it. After we shot that scene, Teresa never looked at me the same way again. Then it was Ellen Sandweiss's turn to endure the hardships of stardom. A scene in the film called for her to race through the woods, dressed only in a nightie and slippers, hoping to escape the evil force. This entailed an entire night of clawing her way literally through the dense foliage around the cabin. Oh, did I mention it was about 40 degrees outside? After the 22nd take, Ellen fell hard and gashed her leg. She began cursing and stated flatly that she couldn't film any more that night. Shooting came to a halt. Rob pulled Josh aside while the crew rapped to point out drops of blood left in Ellen's wake.
I like it when an actor bleeds, he exclaimed.
That's my bad imitation of Rob. That's how we all imitate him.
It makes me feel like I got my money's worth.
Later, it was Betsy Baker's turn. Her big scene took place in a makeshift graveyard up the hill from the cabin. Betsy Baker, as Linda, had just come back from the dead. You've all downloaded the script off the internet, right? As she attempts to kill the dim-witted Ash, me, he defends himself by smashing its murder beams over her head. These styrofoam beams, whose normal use is to create a rustic look in mobile home dens across America, were used extensively in Sam's epic Super 8 film It's Murder, and became identified with the same. The scene was to progress like this. Betsy approaches, I swing, the beam cracks over her head, and she spits out a milky bile. Hoping to avoid putting in the cumbersome white contact lenses, we applied white makeup to her eyelids instead. As long as she kept her eyes closed, you wouldn't really notice the fakery in the middle of a scuffle. Therefore, Betsy had no way of really knowing what was going to hit her, when, or how hard. For her close-up, Sam and I lined up on both sides of the camera with beams to get the maximum number of hits without stopping to reset. Upon action, I would swing my portion of the beam and break it over her head. Sam would then follow this with a blistering smack that would send Betsy into a rage. Sam would apologize, set up for another take, and do the exact same thing again. Here's what you got. Sam.
Action!
Bruce's hit.
Whack!
Sam's hit.
Crack!
Betsy.
God damn it, Sam!
After the third cranium-rattling blow, Betsy defiantly spewed milk, a bile substitute, in every direction, mostly into the camera lens. This, in turn, pissed off the cameraman, Tim Philo. So went a typical night. I wasn't left out of the torment loop, not by a long shot. In fact, since I shared a longer working relationship with Sam than anyone else on the set, I became the very least of Sam's worries. Sam knew too much, way too much, and it worked against me. Now, I'm not crying foul, but I can guarantee that Teresa, Ellen, and even Betsy were nodding to themselves thinking, hey, I gotta wear these damn contact lenses, but at least I don't have to get the living shit beat out of me every day. One occasion got out of hand. After filming yet another vicious graveyard encounter, I ran down a steep hill rejoicing that we had finished the scene. On the way down, my foot caught a root and my ankle turned in a direction that was diametrically opposed to the way I was going. I hit the ground, curled up in pain. Sam and Rob thought this was particularly hilarious and prodded me to get off my ass. There was more to shoot. I managed to get to my feet, but that was about it. Next thing I knew, Sam had a pretty good-sized stick. What the hell is he going to do with that, I thought. Then Rob appeared with one of his own. They circled me like Amazon tribesmen around a downed animal and began poking my ankle. I couldn't help but laugh at the insanity of it all. This misinterpreted angst only spurred them on, and I was soon huddled into a corner of a back room begging, no, pleading for them to stop. The scene we filmed later that night recorded a very visible on-camera limp, and now you can tell the world why. The wrong stuff. Then there was the blood. That damnable stuff. Fake blood is one of the staples of horror films, and ours was no exception. We needed gallons of the goo, and most of it had one destination, me. Within weeks, we had cleaned out every local quick-pick gas-and-go and bait shop of the essential ingredient, Karo syrup. This harmless substance, beloved by pancake eaters across America, became my nemesis. As it dried, Karo, or Karo, as it's pronounced down south, became the inbred cousin of superglue. One night, my shirt broke. Hoping to make my life easier, I hung my Karo-soaked shirt on the back of a chair and placed it directly in front of a space heater. If I just dry the thing, I reasoned to myself, it won't cling to me so horribly and wrench the very hair from my arms. Within minutes, it seemed to be dry. That was an understatement, because my science experiment had created something a little harder than peanut brittle. Upon thrusting my arm into the shirt, a sleeve snapped off and fell to the floor. I tossed the rest of it into the fire. This is a good spot to kind of give you our fake blood recipe. It's in the book, so I'm just going to tell you what you need. Ingredients. 6 pints clear Karo syrup. 3 pints red food coloring. 1 pint non-dairy creamer. 1 drop blue food coloring. Equipment needed. Large ceramic bowl. Medium-sized bowl. Spoon. Cleaning products. Number 1. The Karo syrup is your foundation, the base of your blood. Pour syrup into a large ceramic bowl. Number 2, in the medium bowl, stir the non-dairy creamer until it turns into a nice paste. You got to get all the lumps out. This will provide opacity. Number 3, gradually fold in the non-dairy paste into the syrup. Stir in red food coloring. Add 1 drop of blue food coloring for density. It's also to keep it from getting too pink. If you add too much, it becomes purple. This is pretty complicated. Stick with me here. Number 5, test on a white surface. It's best to see the real color of the blood that way. Number 6, coat the aspiring actor from the top down. After each night of carnage and mayhem, I jump into the back of our rented pickup truck, you know, the one that we wrecked, soaked in blood like a mass murderer, and ride home. One Sunday morning, we passed a series of spit-polished families bound for church. There really wasn't anything I could do but smile and wave like nothing was wrong. Back home, I'd walk straight into the shower, fully clothed, and let the hot water work its magic. The only true solvents of Karo syrup were heat and time. Where the Fun Never Sets. It would be incorrect to portray these 12 weeks as a mirthless exercise in agony. Somewhere along the way, maybe once a month, we managed to have some fun. Our first official reprieve was Thanksgiving, and we celebrated Southern style. I've never had a meal like it before or since. A small army of women, all related somehow to Gary Holt, took 3 days to prepare the fixings. In case you're skimming, that was 3 days. The food was laid out on card tables, buffet style, and ringed two large rooms. I tried to taste a little bit of everything, but this was physically impossible. The sweet potato dishes alone came in 5 varieties. Events like this tended to bring out the best of the South. You would be hard-pressed to find a single family in other parts of the country that would so willingly and happily prepare a veritable feast for 17 people they didn't know, or even like, for that matter. I'm including moonshine under the category of fun, but that was debatable. Mr. Holt introduced us to its charms after weeks of constant prodding. "Come on, Gary, you gotta get us some, you gotta." "Y'all sure you want me to?" he'd warn. "It ain't for kids, this stuff." "Ah, phooey, we're from Detroit." The moonshine that Gary produced didn't really make you drunk. It was too powerful for that. It made you crazy. Gary explained that to test a batch of, quote, shine, you'd pour some into the lid of a mason jar, the only true receptacle, and light it on fire. If it burned a soft blue flame, it was good stuff, but if it burned an orange color, you'd better pass. It was most likely distilled in a car radiator. Armed with shine one night, we decided to go clubbing. In the small burg of Morristown, we had to adjust our big city expectations. The place Gary steered us to was small, really small. Okay, downright clandestine. Across the dim room, we saw a smattering of Southern bells, and I knew I had to get something going. Brazened by a gutful of home-brewed nitroglycerin, I approached a girl and offered what I thought was a unique line. "Pardon me, ma'am." We learned to say sir and ma'am a lot down there. "But have you ever danced with a Northern boy before?" The woman rolled her eyes but stood up and offered her arm. "No." With that, we stumbled to the dance floor. As drunk as I was, I think she actually had a head start on me. We'd dance a step or two, fall down to the dance floor, help each other up, attempt to dance again, and go right back down. Helping her up for the umpteenth time, I detected a pleasant odor. "Excuse me, ma'am, but what's that lovely scent you're wearing?" "Ivory soap," she explained, as if I were a moron, and promptly collapsed. A deep and dark December. The definition of winter. Noun, a period of inactivity or decay. By the end of November, winter was in full swing. Later, we found out that Tennessee had logged one of the harshest winters in recent memory, while Michigan posted a positively balmy one. The muddy driveway to the cabin froze, rendering this difficult at best road impassable by car. The daily long march, lugging equipment and food down the quarter-mile slick road, became positively gulag-like. At the beginning of the shooting day, gravity was our friend. At the end of a 16-hour day, the last thing you wanted to do was haul equipment up that rural slip-and-slide. The cabin, lacking any hint of insulation whatsoever, became astoundingly cold inside. A roaring fire and 2 space heaters didn't seem to help any. Under duress, I developed a theory about personal comfort that dogs me to this day. I reasoned that it was better to keep myself in a mild state of discomfort rather than give in to the false impression of warmth provided by the space heater. By mid-December, I had sworn off any external heat source and preferred instead to shiver uncontrollably. Equipment as well as personnel began to freeze. On the 17th take of an exterior dolly shot, the synchronization cable between the camera and the sound recorder froze, and we were forced to go inside and let it thaw by the fire. As weeks rolled on, this problem became kind of moot because the camera itself would freeze. When in doubt, shemp it. By late December, our original termination date, actors and crew members began to leave in droves. Prior commitments to real jobs or school made it impossible for some to stay. Tim Philo, the director of photography, had to return to Wayne State University in early January. That was all well and good, but Tim had borrowed our main camera, the Aeroflex BL, from their film department, and it was his responsibility to return it. Sam, as captain of this sinking ship, could never allow that to happen. Sam: "But Tim, without the BL, we don't have a backup camera." Tim: "Okay, but if I leave it, you promise not to use it?" "Absolutely." Tim hadn't been gone 5 minutes when Sam turned to Josh. Josh, unpack the BL. Other cast and crew members simply had enough. Faced with this, we were forced to employ an old Super 8 trick, shemping. Being fans of the Three Stooges growing up, we discovered that their shorts of about 20 minutes in length were filmed two or three at a time, thereby capitalizing on sets from the big Columbia A Pictures currently in production. It allowed them, for example, to use a large castle set and shoot a pie fight or something before it was torn down. As a result, they often shot overlapping scenes from different shorts. Well, one day, Shemp, the really ugly one with the long, stringy black hair, who's secretly my favorite, had a heart attack, and the rest of the Stooges, distraught as they were, had to finish off scenes from several shorts. To do this, a fake Shemp was brought in. The double, actor Joe Palma, was the wrong height and weight and lacked true Shemp mannerisms. Even as teenagers, watching the Stooges after school, we could tell whenever the fake Shemp made his appearance, which amounted to four shorts, and it amused us to no end. We then began to use the term fake Shemp for any actor in our Super 8 flicks who didn't have any lines or was doubling for someone else, which seemed to happen a lot when you couldn't pay actors to stay around. With Evil Dead, we decided to elevate Shemping to an official on-screen credit category, mainly because they soon constituted the bulk of our cast. Former film student Kurt Roth was a monster leaping into frame. Super 8 starlet Cheryl Guttridge allowed us to cover her with peat moss in Sam Raimi's garage for a dramatic out-of-the-grave lunge. Sam's brother, Ted, did his best to imitate a pair of tentative feet shuffling across a blood-strewn floor. Local Tennessee actress Barbara Carey endured many nights of wigs, latex applications, and broken fingernails to play the long-departed Betsy Baker. Dorothy Tappert, Rob's sister, spewed blood during a reshoot in a suburban Detroit basement. Even Rob, Mr. Producer, donned a monster wig and doubled for Ellen Sandweiss. The term Shemp has since expanded in our vocabulary to include much broader applications. Shempish, anything that is cheesy or second rate. Man, throw that shirt out.